This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, the standoff at the Venezuelan embassy in Washington continues. African Liberation Day will be marked by protests against the ongoing sanctions against Zimbabwe. And we'll get an African feminist perspective on women's roles in secessionist movements on the continent.
Lots of people know that Chicago recently elected its first Black woman mayor, but the elections also created a sharp change in the city council. Before the people went to the polls in February, only one alderman out of 50 on the council supported community control of the police. However, community activists take credit for changing that equation at the ballot box. After the election, 17 Chicago council members say they will vote to establish CPAC, the Civilian Police Accountability Council. Aislinn Pulley is the founder and co-leader of Black Lives Matter Chicago. We asked Pulley what effect the victories in the city council will have on movement strategy.
Well, now it looks like we have to make sure that all of those 17 individuals stay true to their professed support. And so we need that support to translate into action. So now that we have a solid block of people dedicated who have at least given lip service during their campaign to support CPAC, we need the evidence. We need them to prove that they are in fully support of the CPAC ordinance. And that will be put to a test very soon. So we want the ordinance entered again, and we want it voted upon, and we want it passed.
And these folks, these 17 who are paying, as you say, lip service to community control of the police, one would expect they'd also be in support of community control of the schools.
Exactly. I mean, the fact that in Chicago, having Democratic control over any public entity is controversial, really paints the kind of picture that we're living in. There should be nothing controversial about demanding democratic control over anything. We are the only large municipality in this country that does not have an elected school board. And that really speaks volume to how disenfranchised the population has been, how much our voice has been taken out of governance, out of any semblances of power. And so that's where we are. The buck stops here. We want no more of the prior drive toward neoliberalism and privatizing all of our public institutions and selling them off for profit to make rich people richer. We want no more of the conditions that are driving Black people out of this city. It stops now.
Yes, lots of folks have noted that the weakening of school boards seems to coincide with the growth of Black populations in cities.
Yeah, you know, and we have lost 50 schools. 50 schools were closed by Rahm Emanuel. And in addition to the decimation of our public school system, he waged a decimation over other public services, mental health care. He closed half of our mental health care clinics. We want those reopened and we want them expanded. And we have a real fighting chance to reverse and to chart a new way forward that is a direction that is for the people and that is dedicated to giving voice and giving power to us, the people who live here.
Certainly movement folks are glad to see Rahm Emanuel going, but what about this new Black mayor? What are the prospects with her?
Lori Lightfoot is a federal cop, basically. She was a federal prosecutor. The way that most of organizers of recent have been introduced to her was through her appointment from Rahm Emanuel. as the head of the police board. And as part of the police board, she oversaw their complete inaction. So family members remember that. We were protesting to get Dante Servin, the cop who killed Rekia Boyd, fired. And we were up at that police board hearing every month for over a year, and families of other loved ones who have been killed by police were also present advocating for justice for them. And they remember her response. They remember her silence. They remember her kicking Martinez, Rekia Boyd's brother, out of the courtroom. They remember her kicking all of us out of the police board room. So if history is any indication, we have a fight ahead of us and we are not backing down. We're ready.
I can imagine that movement folks were jubilant with the results in the aldermanic elections, but how has that affected your strategizing in terms of future actions?
Protesting was already underway about this multi-million dollar project on the north side. It's a whole community development project in this already very wealthy and highly resourced area that is predominantly white, called the Lincoln Yards Project, which is using public tax dollars. And so we've already been opposing that and protesting that. For the first time, we had the newly elected city council people join and participate and lead chants. We had three council people show up and were active participants in the protest. We have never had that before. The day before the election, we protested against the FOP, and the Fraternal Order of Police has been trying to unseat and use the whole Jesse Smollett thing in order to unseat and attack the state's attorney, Kim Fox. And what the important thing that they're trying to do that is being obscured by mainstream media is that what they're trying to do is regain control over the entire system of the carceral state in this city. And that means that they are in opposition to Kim Fox because she has not bowed down to them and she has been independent and has not imposed the draconian charges that they are used to getting away with. And so for the first time, they are losing control. And so that's what their protest is about with Jesse Smollett. So we know that. And so we were protesting the FOP. We want to get rid of the FOP. We want to decertify them. So this small sense of their loss of control is just a small taste of what is to come. And we are not ceding any ground. While we were there, we had Jeanette Taylor, who was at that time the candidate for the 20th Ward. And she came. This is the last day of campaigning. And she came and she stood with us against the FOP, against the four white supremacist, white nationalist groups that were there along with the FOP and protested with us. We have never had that before. So we actually have organizers now who have shown up and are still showing up. And that's a new experience.
You spoke of the loss of Black population in Chicago, some of which can certainly be attributed to the hostile environment that's been created for Black people in Chicago. Do movement circles have anything that we might call a grand plan to resist this hostile environment in Chicago?
Yeah, and that plan kind of crosses over the multiple areas of struggle that we've already discussed just within our short conversation. We've had an exodus of almost 300,000 Black people in the city, and it's a direct result of the massive systemic disenfranchisement and disinvestment in our communities. The poverty has gone up, unemployment has gone up. Unemployment for Black people in Illinois is the highest in the nation. There are areas and neighborhoods in Chicago where Black unemployment is as high as 50%. So unemployment combined with the shattering of our public services like schools, the fact that we have so many food deserts and health deserts where we don't have Trauma One centers. We had a four-year fight and just won a Trauma One center on the south side. The west side needs a Trauma One center. All of these things are connected. These are making the conditions unlivable. Combine all of that with a police force that is occupying our neighborhoods, torturing, murdering, harassing our people. It becomes an unlivable situation. So all of these things are connected, which is why this recent election is so important because it's a signal that the people are not going to stop fighting and that the movement has gained enough ground to actually creep into City Hall. And for the first time in 100 years, we have six socialists who are members of our city council, six professed socialists. Our city council right now has the smallest amount of white people ever. These are historic changes that on the surface may not seem as powerful as they really are, but what they do is they signify a significant political shift that is happening in the city.
And are Black activists and Latino activists finding common ground?
Yes, more and more we're seeing that there is a conscious effort to create radical alliances. And so in some of the strongest ways, that has shown up in the movement against unionization. So our charter schools, we just had three charter school strikes that have all been successful. They've all won their demand. They all happened this year. And that's historic. And some of those charter schools, I think two of the three, were in largely Latinx communities. We're fighting to get rid of the gang databases that exist within Cook County as well as CPD. And that is a conscious alignment with our Latinx comrades. So BYP, for example, has been organizing with OCAD, which stands for Organized Communities Against Deportation, in order to end the gang database. And these alliances are so important because the way that we see police interacting and occupying our communities, we are also seeing that very same occupation and tactic being applied to our Latinx brothers and sisters, both in terms of occupation of police as well as ICE. We are hoping that this movement is not confined to Chicago. We are excited by the wins that are happening across the country. And this is a small victory in a longer fight to truly transform this system away from prioritizing making people richer and actually creating a system for the first time that is dedicated to preserving and enhancing welfare and life.
That was Aislinn Pulley of Black Lives Matter Chicago.
Activists with Code Pink, The Answer Coalition, and Popular Resistance continue to occupy the Venezuelan embassy in Washington, keeping it out of the hands of supporters of Juan Guaido, the Venezuelan opposition leader who appointed himself president. The United States has recognized Guaido and has been confiscating Venezuelan property, in addition to imposing punishing sanctions on the country. The American activists inside the embassy were invited in to keep watch on the place by the elected government of Venezuela. Last Friday, we asked Code Pink co-founder Medea Benjamin how she and the others inside the embassy are holding up.
People are resolute. It's getting more and more difficult without food and medicines being able to go inside. And certainly the electricity cutoff is making things problematic. But there's a great spirit of people saying, do what you have to do. We're not coming out of here walking, that's for sure. And then we have a good group of supporters on the outside, and every day new people show up. They're flying in from California, driving from Boston, coming from all over, and they'll spend some hours or they're here in the evenings. And it's been quite a community of resistance that's being built, but it's against a lot of very vociferous and sometimes very nasty and aggressive opposition.
Well, yes. Tell us about those Guaido supporters outside. What kind of people are they and what do they say and do?
I keep saying to them, is this the democracy you want for Venezuela? Because they are, not all of them, of course, but some of them, so mean and aggressive. They turn their bullhorns into sirens and then they have horns as well, that they just blast into our ears, and they have lasers that they shoot right directly into our eyes, and then all night long in the building to try to keep people from sleeping. And they are aggressive and racist and anti-women. They have sexually assaulted one of the women in our organization. And then they are physical. especially when we do any attempt to try to get food inside. For example, since we can't get up to a door, they've blockaded the doors and the police let them. We try to do pulleys and send food up to the window. And when we do that, we get attacked by these people, physically attacked. And if there's a scuffle that ensues, it's our people that get arrested. Already there's been 12 people on our side that have been arrested, all of them for nothing. It's been the fault of the opposition pushing and shoving us. And one other incident, they have surrounded the entire building with canopies and tents. And when we tried to put one up by the building, my partner Tag Barry got arrested and held in jail for 3 days for that. And this has just been a day-to-day aggressive scene since they showed up at the beginning of May.
The responsibility for protecting embassies is with the Secret Service, but the D.C. police have their responsibilities too. Tell me about the behavior of those two police forces and how they interact.
The D.C. police, I don't know why they're even here because they don't do anything. They stand across the street and they just watch. When the sidewalk is totally blockaded by the Guaido people, their tents are all the way into the sidewalk. They allow that to happen. They say that the Secret Service now has responsibility for that. And that's their excuse for everything. In terms of the Secret Service, they are in collusion with the pro-Guaido forces and the U.S. State Department. They can basically get away with doing whatever they want and nothing happens to them.
So you're saying that the Guaido supporters hurl racial epithets and the D.C. police, who are largely black, don't respond?
Absolutely. And the Guaido people physically assault us, and we have it on camera. There was one incident where myself and two others were physically assaulted by a man jumping over a barricade and coming and grabbing, pushing us aside violently to grab a bag from us. And the Secret Service wouldn't even look at it on tape. They didn't want to see the evidence. They took us aside and said, if you really want this man arrested, which we did, then I will arrest all of you, all four of you, which is insane. When did you ever hear of anything like that? So, yes, the Secret Service, I think the Secret Service are whiter than the D.C. police, but none of them do anything.
Now, in the early stages of this incident, we didn't see much coverage by the corporate media. Are they paying attention yet?
Well, in the early stages, it was very quiet. For 3 weeks, we were going in and out of the embassy as we pleased. We were taking shifts sleeping there. We could bring in food. In fact, we had events. We had large gatherings, and we would feed 100 people in there. It was quite nice, and there wasn't a sign of the opposition. So it really is since May 1st that the whole atmosphere has changed here. And in terms of mainstream press, they're just starting to cover it. In fact, I had my first interview about an hour ago with the New York Times, so they've waited for a month to cover this. And some of the press that we've gotten has been negative, saying that we're not Venezuelan, why should we be in the embassy? Of course, we say there were about 100 Venezuelans working into the embassy until they were all forced to leave. And we represent millions of Venezuelans who either support the Maduro government or don't support a U.S. intervention and don't want to see this embassy issue escalate to the point where it could be a justification for U.S. intervention.
And what has the official Trump administration's position been?
They have said, Elliot Abrams has said it, and in the State Department, they've said that we are here illegally and we should leave, but they have never given us any kind of written order or contacted us directly to say we should leave. So there are obviously legal reasons that they haven't come in to evict us. And of course, there's concern about what would happen to their embassy in Venezuela.
So how long do you plan to stay?
Plan to stay as long as we have to until there is some agreement on how the embassy will be dealt with. We don't want the Guaido supporters to get the embassy. We would much rather there be an agreement between both countries that third parties, like Switzerland has done in the case of the Cuban embassy, they called it an intersection In the case of Iran here in D.C., their embassy was downgraded to an intersection and it's under the protection of Pakistan. So we want one of those kinds of arrangements to be worked out. We would hate, after all of this sacrifice, after all of this struggle, to leave here only to have the Guaido people enter the building. And remember, Glenn, they have no diplomatic powers or consular powers. They couldn't issue a passport or a visa or do anything that would require the approval in Venezuela because they don't have any power inside Venezuela.
But this is consistent with Guaido's policy in Venezuela, which is not to negotiate with the Maduro government.
Absolutely. We are saying not only negotiate the embassies, but negotiate the whole issue. It's interesting that reports have come out recently about Trump questioning the information he's been given by John Bolton, that the Maduro government was ready to fall, that the military would immediately defect. And obviously, this hasn't been the case. So there must be quite a deep divide within the government about how to proceed. And we are hoping that the cooler heads prevail and recognize that an intervention could lead to U.S. being bogged down for more decades, more U.S. soldiers dying, more Venezuelans killing each other, mayhem that could spread out to other parts of the region. So let's hope that John Bolton not only doesn't get his way in this, but I think between what he is doing in Venezuela and Iran are really starting to be questioned by Donald Trump. And what we can really hope for is that he decides to fire John Bolton.
And are you in regular contact with the Venezuelan government, whose property you are safeguarding?
Yes, we're in constant contact with them for all kinds of things, logistical things about what we can and can't do inside the embassy, because we want to really protect the integrity of the building. But we're also asking them about how any kind of solution is going, how negotiations are going, and that kind of thing. So we are in regular contact both with people in Caracas as well as folks in Washington, D.C.
And they're encouraging you to stay.
Well, they don't like that we're getting hurt, and they don't like that we don't have electricity or food right now. And they are certainly saying, thank you for doing this, but you don't have to do this. We're not doing this for the Maduro government. We're really doing this for ourselves and our government to stop our government's interference. And so we tell them we think this is our struggle as well. And we just happen to coincide in this issue of not wanting interference by a foreign government in the internal affairs, something that supposedly American people are incensed about when they think that Russians are involved in our elections. But to think that the U.S. is so actively involved in trying to overthrow another government, not just influence it, but really do regime change, I think this is appalling. And I think most people around the country, whether they're left, right, Democrat, Republican, independent, green, whatever, are not really anxious to see the U.S. get involved in another war.
And you frame this as a kind of peacekeeping mission, in that if the U.S. government allows the Guaido people to seize the embassy, then the Maduro government in Venezuela might feel obligated to seize the U.S. embassy in Caracas, and that might be a pretext that the Trump regime would use to declare war.
That's right. You know, you never know what is going to spark a war. And when there are people like Elliot Abrams and John Bolton and even Mike Pompeo and Mike Pence, I would say the four of them, in positions of such power, they are always looking for how can they ignite a war. I think the episode they did on the border between Colombia and Venezuela on February 23rd of trying to, quote, get humanitarian aid in, but really as part of an attempt at an uprising and a coup, that failed. And so they've tried other ones, just as they said on May 1st, people were going to rise up and that didn't happen. So yes, there is a constant effort on the part of the war hawks in the U.S. government to find an excuse. And it would certainly be an excuse that the American people might buy if it were phrased in the way of, oh my God, look what the Maduro people did. They breached the U.S. embassy. And of course, there's probably nobody there except people physically watching the building, but this would be portrayed to the U.S. people as something akin to the hostage crisis back in 1979 in Iran, which many older Americans have still not forgotten because of the daily news coverage that it generated.
That was Medea Benjamin of Code Pink inside the Venezuelan embassy in Washington.
African Liberation Day is May 25th, and Zimbabwe is on top of the agenda. We spoke with human rights lawyer Roger Wareham of the Brooklyn, New York-based December 12th movement.
Saturday, May 25th is the observation of African Liberation Day, which was really set up by the then OAU back in 1963 and first observed in the United States back on May 27th, 1972. There was African Liberation Day observances in Washington, D.C. and San Francisco. This African Liberation Day, the theme is lifting the sanctions on Zimbabwe, that they were demanding that the United States lift the sanctions that it's had on Zimbabwe since 2001. From the understanding, you know, sometimes people hear the word sanctions and they think it's something benign. And the United States cloaks sanctions in that type of language, which does not really reflect the damage that sanctions cause. Sanctions are a weapon of war. They are calculated to destroy the economy of whoever is being targeted. There's a very famous statement back in 1973 when the United States government was attempting and actually eventually succeeded in overthrowing the government, the socialist government of Salvador Allende in Chile. And that was a government that was democratically elected. But the United States put sanctions on them and caused so much pain in the economy that at the point when there was a military coup, many of the people went along with it. So that's what they're doing now in Zimbabwe. Zimbabwe is being punished for having had the temerity, the audacity to take back its land and give it to its people. And we want people to come out and understand that whether or not you agree with everything Zimbabwe has done or not, they have the right as an independent, sovereign nation to exercise its right to self-determination without interference from the U.S. government. So on May 25th, we're going to have a rally in Washington, D.C., starting at the African-American Civil War Veterans Memorial Plaza, which is up there on Vermont Avenue and Avenue U. We're going to march to the White House to make our demands on the White House to lift the sanctions on Zimbabwe.
Now, the United States is sanctioning a whole range of countries around the world and a long list of individuals in various countries. But tell us about the history of the sanctions against Zimbabwe and the damage that's been done.
Certainly. And as you said, people are very well aware now in terms of what's happening in Venezuela and what the sanctions have done to its economy. In Zimbabwe, the Zimbabwe Democracy and Economic Recovery Act, which was passed in 2001 by the Congress and had been co-sponsored by Hillary Clinton and Jesse Helms, which is quite an interesting coupling, provided for on one level that no countries would have any bilateral economic relationships with Zimbabwe, which then meant that their economy was isolated and could not get what it needed to develop. The effect it's had on the economy has been cutbacks in healthcare in terms of not being able to get the medicines and equipment that they need to treat their people. They do not get chemicals to treat the water that prevents cholera. So they've had cholera outbreaks because they lack either the chemicals or to replace the treatment facilities when there's breakdowns in the parts of the treatment facilities to be able to get the parts for that. They have not been able to get loans in terms of economic development, which means that people end up being unemployed because there's just not the facility for them to work because they don't have the loans. There's cutbacks in gas, there's long lines for gas. It wreaks havoc with the monetary system. And because they did not have access to money, they really were forced to print money that caused a tremendous inflation rate, probably one of the highest inflation rates in history, which then meant that people could not get the few goods that were available. At one point, when we were there in 2008, supermarkets had practically no supplies. So there's an ongoing suffering. And for people who think that the effect of those are immediate in terms of hunger, in terms of deteriorating health conditions, and also in terms of death. I was reading a report the other day about the sanctions that the United States had imposed on Iraq. And in the war in Iraq, I believe maybe 37,000 people died. But the sanctions that were imposed on Iraq, nearly 1 million children died. And that's the unseen hand of sanctions, which is why we call them a weapon of mass destruction. That it is a declaration of war and that the people of Zimbabwe have suffered from it. The United States says, oh, no, this hasn't affected the entire country. They're targeted sanctions. But that's a myth. The targeted sanctions really don't affect the people who are higher up. The effect is on the people on the ground. And so that's why we want people to understand that, as you said, the United States is exacting sanctions and implementing sanctions around the world. But you never hear about Zimbabwe in terms of the sanctions. You hear about Venezuela, you hear about Cuba, but you do not hear about Africa. But particularly for Black people, it's important to understand the significance of Zimbabwe in terms of having taken their land back, being punished for that, and to understand the devastation that's being caused by the sanctions and to take a position around it, particularly to make demands on the Congressional Black Caucus. I'm sure Glenn, your listeners will remember, and maybe they won't, but the Congressional Black Caucus grew out of the Black Power movement in the late 60s and early 70s. And the people who were part of that, the elected representatives, felt a responsibility to represent the interests of Black people and of African people around the world as elected representatives. These were representatives who stood up for Black people, who stood up for Africa. And today what you have are Black elected representatives who are basically following the line of Trump around not only maintaining the sanctions, but last year they passed a bill that was signed on by the Congressional Black Caucus representatives to exact even more penalties in order for the sanctions to be lifted. The Zimbabwe Democracy and Economic Recovery Act, ZEDERA, says that there's no democracy in Zimbabwe and that it will be the president of the United States who will conclude when democracy has been restored. And when that has happened, the president can lift the sanctions. And we know that the president and presidents really are not the ones to determine whether democracy has been restored in the country where the sitting president had 3 million votes less than the loser, as an example of democracy. So what we want your listeners to and readers to do is to make a demand on the members of the Congressional Black Caucus, that they make a demand on the president to lift the sanctions, to publicize the damage that the sanctions are causing to ordinary people in Zimbabwe. And so that's one of the things we want to come out in terms of the march and rally on May 25th, that what people take away from that is to put more pressure on the Congressional Black Caucus to really go back to its roots and not simply be a rubber stamp for President Trump when he's striking out at Zimbabwe in particular and Africa in general.
Now, you're a lawyer, and much of the work you do deals with international law. And you say that sanctions, certainly as they are practiced by the United States, violate international law. Where is that legal battle being fought out?
Well, that's very interesting in terms of the United States' violation of international law through sanctions. At one point, it's raised inside of the United Nations, but not much happens with it. We would like to take it to the International Criminal Court. The problem, of course, being that the United States is not a party to the International Criminal Court. Other places where it could possibly be fought out is in the Organization of American States, which right now is the United States is trying to exercise its Monroe Doctrine control over certain countries in the Organization of American States. It's an area where it should be able to be fought out, but where it isn't. And it's been taken to different organs of the Human Rights Council to raise that the sanctions are a violation of human rights. So it's a difficult row to hoe in terms of the international law. We continue to raise it up.
Yes, but of course, as you said, ultimately, this is a political struggle. And in the United States, we have 50 members of the Congressional Black Caucus. And one would think, in terms of black issues, that would be the terrain. But as you said, the Black Caucus hasn't had anything positive to say about black liberation internationally since the Free South Africa movement.
No, that's very true. The Black Caucus needs to get back to where it came from. And the only way that will happen is that the voters, that the people in their districts make that demand. Because in reality, the lifting of the sanctions on Zimbabwe is going to come down to how do we on the ground, how much pressure do we put on our elected representatives, and how much pressure can they put on the president to make that happen? That's how it's going to be resolved, which is why we think it's really important that people who are in D.C. come out to the rally, people who are in New York, if they're interested in riding with us, we're going to take buses down there. And if they're interested in doing that, they should give us a call at 718-398-1766. That's 718-398-1766. Bodies on the ground, in the streets, are what's really going to make the difference. But we can no longer just give our votes to black people because they're black if they're not going to adhere to any kind of principle or commitment to the community from which they come and in whom they purport to represent, and also to reflect the international Pan-African view that all African people have some things in common, no matter where we're located, in terms of having been victims of the slave trade, colonialism, neocolonialism, and that history binds us, even with our differences, and that continues to this day. And it gets reflected in terms of the rise of white nationalism, of white supremacy, that we have to understand. That's a wake-up call, whether we're in Harlem or in Harare or in Johannesburg or in Addis Ababa or in Lagos. We have to understand that we have things in common and that it's important for us to work together. Our elected representatives, to the extent that they don't want to do that, we need to not elect them. And we need to make that clear to them that there's going to be a penalty imposed for not fulfilling their obligations, not fulfilling their commitment, not fulfilling their responsibility to African people here and around the globe, and particularly around Zimbabwe.
And in that sense, isn't Caracas also a scene of much the same struggle? Afro-Venezuelans overwhelmingly support the current government, and the opposition is quite visibly very white.
Caracas, Venezuela is an important example of the need for Pan-Africanism. President Chavez, Hugo Chavez, always maintained I was very proud of his heritage of African descent and of indigenous. And President Maduro has carried on that affiliation. Afro-Venezuelans are the ones who are suffering most from the sanctions. Afro-Venezuelans are the ones who are the base of support for President Maduro. President Maduro is well aware of that. Last year, he had a conference in terms of pushing the question of reparations inside the United Nations, of supporting the UN International Decade for People of African Descent. He's going to be having a series of conferences around reparations inside the United States over the next few months. And so we have to understand that black people in Venezuela are the ones who are being hit hardest by these sanctions, yet they're the ones who continue to support the government of President Maduro. So they're suffering because of their adherence to principle, whereas our black elected representatives are basically kowtowing. So we have to continue to make that demand. In the end, all of this is a political resolution, and not political simply in the sense of voting Democratic or Republican, but political in the larger sense of what controls this country, who is the determining force in this country. And we say it's the masses of people once that they are conscious and mobilized. And so the African Liberation Day this year, U.S. hands off Zimbabwe, U.S. hands off Venezuela, end the sanctions now is the theme. And we want people to spread the word, come out, support it. And as I said, give us a call if you're interested in going to D.C. from the New York City area.
That was Roger Wareham of the December 12th Movement, speaking from New York City.
Not all people in Africa are satisfied with the borders that were drawn around their countries by European colonizers. Jacqueline Bethel Mugwe is a feminist scholar and professor of history at Baylor University, who's been studying the roles that women play in secessionist movements in Africa.
These are struggles that are really about the African other. When we had the independence movement, or the struggle for independence, it was one in which they were struggling for independence from separation from a European other, so a foreign other. And what you see with secessionist movements is the continual struggle for larger ideas about national identity and also autonomy within the country or within one nation. So secessionist struggles oftentimes tend to other Africans that are in their country. And I found that one thing that we see with the secessionist movement is that gender roles and conduct specifically for women fluctuated more in secessionist movement than they did in the independence movement. And women often face challenges accessing or obtaining social, political, economic, and educational rights for a very long time in these volatile environments. In the independence movement, what you saw was suspension of things being politically stable for a particular period of time. And secessionist movements, we really don't know when they're going to end. So they tend to be ongoing.
Yes, most of the secessionist movements in Africa have been unsuccessful or not yet successful, the exceptions being Eritrea and South Sudan. Have you had any opportunities to study those movements?
Yes. When I look at Cameroon, for example, which is both Francophone and Anglophone because of dual European rule, I often compare the English-speaking part of Cameroon to what happened in South Sudan. As we know, in South Sudan, the secessionist movement there took decades. It was very long. And when you look at the aftermath of what's going on, there's still a lot of struggle. So for Anglophone Cameroon, there's a lot of comparison because for South Sudan, one of the reasons their struggle took so long was because of the discovery of oil. And in Anglophone Cameroon, you had a couple discovery of oil, which made the Francophone state, so the hegemonic state, very reluctant to let that part of the country go. And so as we speak right now, there was an ongoing secessionist movement that is being pacified by the Francophone state.
You write that women have been central in shaping African political identities, especially within secessionist movements. Could you give some examples?
Yes. If we look at Cameroon or Morocco, these women are using traditional ideas about power in order to drive the secessionist movement. In Cameroon, for example, women have long had access to traditional power that has been available to them for a very long time. And women have revamped this traditional power to be critical and essential to the secessionist movement. And one of the things that is at the core of these traditional power or these traditional women's organization is this idea that women's maternal authority is essential. So in Anglophone Cameroon, women have revamped or they continue to use this idea that we are mothers of the state, we are mothers of the sons and our daughters who are fighting for this movement, and our role in society and within the state is essential, and we must be heard. And so women are now using these traditional women's organizations to emphasize their key role. But you also have these growing, particularly feminist organizations in Cameroon that have been really developed and organized by young adult women who are on the ground, who are asking for gender equality in various ways, and they're asking for ceasefire. And they're very, very active.
Do feminists from outside of Africa often fail to recognize women's struggles when they come in traditional forms?
They absolutely do. And that's because they don't recognize essentially how many African women have understood what it means to be feminist. And so when we say feminist, we really need to put it in plural terms. So feminism, particularly on the African continent, there are various ideas of it and how it plays out. In a lot of the areas that I looked at in my research, so it was a transnational research looking at Angola, Nigeria, Cameroon, and Morocco, all of these organizations, or all of these secessionist movements, what you see is that women, not only do they play a central role, but they also emphasize motherhood. And they claim, or they see motherhood as a way in which to gain authority and power. So if you have a Western feminist coming from the outside, she may not see that this idea of motherhood as being critical to African feminist notions or practices and actions on the continent. Motherhood is this sort of critical point or this key aspect that does drive many ideas about African feminism on the continent.
And yet you note that at the heights of struggle, women who are involved in that struggle often postpone assuming traditional duties like motherhood.
Yes, they absolutely do, because they see the secessionist movement as one in which it's about looking at a larger struggle, and that they must unify with men, and that women themselves have a particular role to play. And so what you start to see is these militarized ideas about womanhood. And so these militarized ideas about achieving ideal traits of womanhood. And so women often say, I am not going to have children. I'm not going to be married until my people are free. Now, what it means by a people, now that's a different conversation, because at this point, it's about looking at the African other. And when I looked at Angola, women there who were fighting for the secessionist movement, particularly where the mothers were saying, I am happy to give up my son to the struggle. I am happy for him to die for us to be free. And if you look at Morocco with the Sahrawi people, the women that I was looking at had the mentality that I will not get married. I will not have children. What type of society will there be if our people are not free? I need to focus on becoming free and helping my people become free before I get married and have children.
In your essays, Focus on Biafra, you tell us about the use of female nakedness as a political weapon.
Yes, and that is actually something you see in several or many African societies. So Biafra, you have women where there's this sort of understanding that when women, that nakedness is a potent power. It is one in which when women strip themselves naked, it is to highlight this message that we are very upset about what is going on. And so it also becomes even more underlined or highlighted when it's women who have reached menopause that strip naked. And so there's this sort of perception or understanding that, oh, our grandmothers are stripping naked and something serious is happening. And you have women in Cameroon who are also doing something very similar. And so this idea about stripping naked to protest is one way in which women use their bodies as a political tool to send very serious messages.
In the case of the Sahrawi women of the former Spanish Sahara, the Polisario organization, that struggle's been going on for a very long time, several generations, with great loss mm-hmm. of life among the men. Mm-hmm. How has that impacted the way women have organized themselves in Polisario?
Well, one thing that I found was particularly women in the refugee camps, so these communities and exile outside of Morocco, have garnered more authority and power than ever before in these refugee camps. They're the ones that are leading the community, the teacher organizing as well. But I'm also careful to emphasize that the Sahrawi people particularly, it's been a community of people in which women have always had some sort of authority and power for a long time. And so I'm careful to argue and to emphasize the fact that the authority and power that women have today is not always a direct outcome of their struggle for independence. It is something that is a continuing aspect of their lives. And that's one way in which they're slightly different than the women that I look in other parts of the continent.
You say that there's surprisingly little feminist scholarship on militarism in Africa. Is this the void you're filling?
Yes, it is. There is starting to be growing scholarship. We have Alicia Decker at Penn State, Amina Mama at UC Davis, but there is not that much conversation about what women are doing within highly militarized and volatile settings. And when I say what women are doing, I mean the agency and authority and power that women exercise. We tend to, or the media or popular literature tends to portray women as mostly passive victims, as mostly victims of men's violent actions within militarized settings. And my research is showing that, no, that's all not always necessarily true. Women also exercise agency and power in various ways that we may not recognize. And that's important to see women's agency and women's realities on the ground in a complex way.
Have you seen examples of the clash of women, those women who are involved in armed struggle and those women who are agitating for peaceful solutions?
Yes, there are tensions. So the women's organizations in Cameroon that I was referencing to, particularly the feminist women's organizations, they are asking for ceasefire. They're asking for tensions on both sides and conflicts that are happening. They're asking for both sides to lay their arms down. And they're saying, we don't want to be a part of this independence movement. It is actually impacting women and girls more than it is men. And so these feminist organizations have a list. And I've spoken to some of the leaders of the feminist organizations, and their efforts, they're emphasizing ceasefire. They want the violent conflict to end. And so they're really not positioning themselves as part of the Anglophone Cameroonian independence movement. But at the same time, they're not aligning themselves with the larger Francophone state. It's about peace, particularly for women and girls. But then you have the traditional women's organizations that have been mobilizing and have been really backing the Anglophone Cameroonian struggle for independence that have a very different focus. And they're particularly using their maternal authority and, you know, ideas about motherhood to back this struggle for independence. So there is tension. But I would say that ultimately, the traditional women's organization and the feminist women's organization, one thing that they both want is they want peace. But what does peace look like is we're not sure right now.
Every movement on any large continent has its distinctive characteristics, but Africa has been home for a whole variety of movements.
As a historian, one of the things is that I see this large difference between the decolonization movement and the ongoing secessionist movement on the continent, particularly at how we look at that through African feminist lenses. So an African feminist, one of my concerns are the need conditions of the woman on the continent. So I found that secessionist movements often face opposition from powerful states that want to protect their own political interests. and also protect their geographic boundaries. And they do that with military force. And when using military force, it has the potential to displace thousands of people. So what does that mean for women? Displacement can often expose women to these heightened levels of gender-based violence, particularly within the refugee camps, where you have local and national authority, as well as international peacekeeping forces that may prey on them. However, in this work, I also assert that women can also experience new opportunities and challenges if war does break out during or after secession, which means that we must really carefully examine the entire secession process through a feminist lens, and from my particular research, through an African feminist lens.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host, Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.